Welcome back to another episode of Scalescape. It's your host, Justin. If you know me, you know that I'm a fan of great entrepreneurs, which is why I'm so excited to speak to Chen Chao, the co-founder of Fave, today. In this episode, we look at their journey from 0 to 100 and how they scaled to great heights. Enjoy. Welcome, Chen Chao, to Scalescape. Thank you so much for taking the time to come in on the show. I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of Fave, and I really appreciate you coming on the show, so thank you for coming.
Yeah, hi, Justin. Thanks a lot for having me on this Scalescape. For me, it's definitely an honor, and really thanks a lot for being a huge fan of Fave.
Awesome. To kick things off, Chen Chao, we were talking a little bit last time about Fave and a little bit about what you're doing right now. But for our audience, I know that Fave evolved from KFIT originally, right? But can you, tell us a little bit about yourself and a little brief introduction to Fave?
Yeah, so I started my career in Accenture, so as a management consultant, and then I went on jobstreet.com, which is basically one of the early startup in Malaysia looking into the career space and as a product manager. And after that, in 2011, I joined Joel in Groupon. So that time, Joel and Kylie just sold GroupSmall to Groupon. And that was when the formation of the Groupon Malaysia started there. And then in 2015, a YOLO moment came and decided to quit everything. And I think that's where we started KFIT, right? So KFIT is a fitness sharing platform at that time. So think of it as like similar like ClassPass. The concept is similar. If you think of Amazon start from books, Facebook started from Ivy League universities. So I think that's where we started from KFIT, the fitness segment. And then from there, we built upon. And 1 year after that, in 2016, we soft launched Fave. At the same time, we had opportunities to acquire Groupon subsidiaries in Southeast Asia. And I think that's where we formed up Fave and took it over the Groupon subsidiaries in Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, rebranded, integrated, migrated, and built, and then went on to build Fave from 2017.
Right. And honestly, I think that story is very cool. And I like the analogy. Like you said, Amazon started off with, just one, thing. Facebook also just started off with one thing. And I think when you do that one thing right first, then it leads, it sets you up for a path to be able to expand onto other things, right? And so maybe could you tell us a little bit about, when you pivoted from KFIT to Fave, what was the, the value proposition then of Fave, right? And what pain point was Fave meant to solve?
Yeah, so I think the way we look at it is, I think there are two parts at that time, right? So I think one is looking at how for merchants, so the thing on local businesses, for them to basically drive more values from their customers, right? So I think when we were in Groupon, Groupon was running a deal site. So they bring a lot of the first-time customer, people that who were doing their trials, people that who look for steep discounts. So that was what that segment is. We knew what purpose it served, but we also know what's the gap of that business model. So I think as we go build on Fave, I think we say, okay, let's look at holistically. How do we help the merchants across board, right? So I think one is that, so at the time from the deal, so we keep on the deals that we have in from Groupon, and then from there we build on FavePay. So FavePay basically is a merchant cashback, enable customers to earn a cashback and go back to the same store. So which means that for merchants, if, for example, I run a cafe ABC, I will be able to then reward cashback for customers to come back to my cafe ABC, and which is something that back then, if you think on it, a big companies like Starbucks will be able to retain their customers, but with small ones will be finding it difficult. So I think that's sort of where and how we sort of started from both consumer and merchant angles. And I think understanding that, and I think basically this brings to the merchant, not just the discount hunter, but the customers that will walk in and pay full price, and the customers that will want to come back the next time within the next 1 to 3 months, right? So I think that's sort of the proposition that we went in and connect that dots between the two to bring win-win value for the customer and merchants.
Right. And I really, really like that. I think that win-win sort of value proposition is amazing, because on the merchant end, you're able to increase customer retention, and you're also helping them with, their growth funnel, but then also with the consumer end, with the whole cashback and a different discount and different varieties of merchants. I think that's also a huge win. So definitely, again, such a fan of Fave. So, really, really good. I wanted to ask as well, back then and, through right now, were there any competitors, right? And how were you able to retain your competitive advantage?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it, think of it, the space is huge, right? So if you think on it, any consumers will eat, will buy things and whatnot, right? So basically any consumer could be relevant. So the space is huge. For merchants as well, we're looking at across multiple categories, dine-in, beauty, wellness, services, hotels, and attraction, tourist attractions, events, all those kind of things. So it's a wide segment, right? Huge market. So I think the way I look at it is definitely different people playing at a different segment of it. So I think we focus a lot into merchants that who want to retain their customers. So I think that, yes, we provide payments, facilitations, we provide deals at that time, right? And then now we have a few more other aspects. But I think that at that time, think of it is that the key focus is on merchants that who look at it and say, okay, now I have a bunch of customers been to my store. I'm not like Starbucks level where I can't build my entire CRM. How do I get to a plug and play and retain my customers? So I think that's sort of where we started. And we found a sweet spot initially at the start 2017 or so. It's a lot of the merchants as maybe 2-3 outlets to 20, 30 outlets. That was the first segments that really caught on for Faith.
I think that's really interesting. Because like you said, right, when you're able to really drive in on that merchant market and you're able to really present a very clear value proposition and you know, focus on a very specific sort of area in which you want to really drive a lot of value in, then that starts or really paves a starting point for, you know, the rest of, I guess, expansion into the market. Right. What kind of macro conditions enabled Fave's success within Southeast Asia? Were you able to, capitalize off of any macro factors that, you know, allowed Fave to also be very successful?
Yeah, interesting questions. Right. So I think there are definitely a few tailwinds. Right. We look at macro factors that drive. So I think one is that I think as people drive towards digitalization, people drive through to cashless. So I think it's a huge market, right? So if you look at it as a consumer, over the last 10 years, we have so many apps. And if you think of it, right, apps just started slightly more than 10 years, 10 plus years, right? Like, so it's not a whole long time, but I think the last 10 years, most of our time's on the phone is now on apps and rather than browser, right? So I think that enabled quite a lot of digitization. So consumers are technology savvy. Think of it whenever we call a rides, whenever we want to order any food, want to buy things, all have changed in the last 10 plus years. Take Malaysia. 5 years ago, when people go to shop, you actually can only pay cash or you give your credit cards, nothing else, right? And credit card in Malaysia is still about maybe 3 million people that have it, right? So which is 10% population. Of course, the people that have credit card has a few pieces of credit card, right? So I think that sort of drive the play where people now enable multiple payments, convenience. And I think that's, and I think for businesses as well, because they themselves are also consumer on their end. So they have already seen that. And I think that in the good old days, a lot of time, technology means a lot of capital investment. But nowadays, with all this, like say Fave and all these kind of solutions, today there's no capex for any businesses, right? So basically, they can turn on. So today, any business want to sign on FavePay, they can basically just turn on within minutes, right? And basically go on it and start giving cash back to their customers. So that's sort of where it is. And I think COVID does bring another layer of it, right? So in the short run, COVID was a disruption. But in the midterm, COVID is a addition, right? Because there's a more driving force towards the the cashless, in the sense that people may be scared of COVID virus, so people don't want to touch the physical cash. And hence, these are all factors that drive towards that. And I think bring for Fave or the whole industry going forward.
Right. I think that's an interesting tailwind to look at. Definitely because digitalization is able to drive a lot of this cashless payments, mobile first generation, we're all digital natives, and that's only going to increase in the future. Right. And also with COVID, definitely. So a definite disruption in the beginning. But then I think companies that are able to, I think, thrive off of the, contactless, cashless sort of model and digital model. I think those were the companies that were able to thrive. And like you mentioned, definitely, I think that would have helped that was another tailwind for Fave's sort of progression. And very interesting to look at as well. With building and scaling Fave, right? What kind of difficulties did you face and how are you able to overcome them?
Yeah, so I think if you think on it in a journey to build, right, when we first go in, the markets, a lot of the merchant restaurants, think of it that a lot of them they have built their business, the restaurant retails, for the last 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, right? A lot of them, the family business and whatnot, right? So I think for them, especially the parent, the elderly that who still own the business or who may still have quite a lot of influence or control in the business, initial years, there's a lot of like pushback from them, right? It's like maybe their kids who are newly going into the business say, hey, let's go on this wave, right? Digitalization, technology, everything. But the parents are like, hey, wait, I have been running my cafe for the last 20, 30 years, 40 years. And it has been fine. So why do I need to go there, right? I've been running my retailers all this while, right? So I think the challenge is where for the businesses to believe that technology can solve, and because they are quite worried that, oh, now I can't see my physical money, right? Because if you think on it, for someone that's 60 years old, 70 years old, every customer back then was paying cash. So they see that piece of physical cash in front of them, right? And now it's all in virtual, right? So then it's in the app. You see, oh, today you get $350. Okay, but I don't see that dollar. I mean, it eventually go to the bank account quite the next day or so. But then it's just that they don't see it there. So I think that was one of the thing that moved through. And I think the second one, which was aided by COVID, is also that I think the process. So I think back then, pre-COVID, right, a lot of them still prefer physical signature because it's still a lot of face-to-face touch signature. And I think COVID, prior to COVID, we have already tried to drive that, right, to say more people to drive to digital signatures so that it create greater efficiency for us as well, for our team. So I think but I think COVID definitely helps that in that sense where businesses now can be quickly jump on a quick call, video call, and just discuss it and then say, let's go ahead. And then instead of like needing to go make a trip, go there to meet, to have small chats and then sign that contract, now you could basically virtual and then do a digital signature, click a button and go through. Right? Of course, it's not that so easy because not many of them at the start familiar with this, but I think now more and more of them are familiar with it. And I think for consumer as well, in the initial years is that people are not used to paying something offline through online, right? I think at that time, maybe people have bought it through e-commerce, a few Shopee, Lazada, maybe flight tickets through AirAsia, maybe book a ride to Grab or Uber, a few other things, right? But that's what maybe a few years ago. So, and I think nowadays people are comfortable, more and more of them comfortable to buy things and do things across online. So I think those were some of the challenges that the early years that we went
through. Right. I really like that because I think with the merchant side, you're able to identify that, you know, there's a little bit of an issue with in terms of the adoption, right? So for these like 60 and 70 year old elderly people that they are not very in tune with technology, it's a bit difficult for them to adopt, you know, a different kind of like technology that they're not used to because like you said, they're very used to cash and, you know, they don't really understand or maybe might quite grasp the concept of say like digital payment. So I think that definitely must have been a difficulty. How were you able to overcome that specifically?
Yeah, so I think some of it is like, let's say example, at the earlier years, 2017, 2018, where you deploy some of the people on ground at the shops. And basically, if let's say that someone elderly say, okay, I want to pay, but I don't know how. So that time, of course, there's no COVID scare. So people will be, okay, this is my phone, and help me download and help me build through the registration and everything, right? And we try to create it in a simple registration where if you have a Google or Facebook or Grab account, you basically press a button and basically it connect into that account. And as long as your account is locked in into those apps in your phone, then you are auto connected into that. So I think those helps simplify it. And then I think help them to look through great simple function where they can just scan the card instead of needing to type in the cards and then that captured through and whatnot. So I think make it simple, I think was one of the thing. And then going through on ground, explaining, building through. And I think it's confidence. A lot of time, I think what we found is that, let's say the housewife segments, they initially didn't really know how to use it. But once they learn how to use it, they actually would go and tell everyone else, right? So because they are the ones that, oh, now I know how to use it. Let me show off to my friends and say, hey, I'm smart. I know how to use it.
Got it. I think that's really interesting. I think when it comes to like overcoming challenges with adoption, it's very important for to make the user interface as engaging, but also as simple as possible, like you mentioned, right? Because when you make a lot of these like interfaces a lot more simple, then I think that decreases the barrier to access and the barrier to consume. So I think that was that's a great point that you mentioned. Moving on a little bit towards the relationship between Fave and Pine Labs. Prior to the acquisition, with your existing investor group, what kind of value add did they bring to the table outside of financial capital? And I ask this because a lot of listeners are always curious about what kind of value add that they should be looking for. So I could maybe listen to your opinion.
Yeah, so I think over the years, quite a lot of investors have invested into Fave, right? So during our journey, so I think prior to Pine Labs, this was, I'm talking about maybe 2015, 2018, where we did our pre-seed all the way to Series B stage. So I think, yeah, we say that the investors brought in a few things, right? So I think one, let me take a quote, let's say take Sequoia Capital. So I think they have seen all the giants in the world, right, that have happened through them. Mm. And I think that basically they brought in a lot of amazing perspectives for us to learn. Like every year they would do a gathering of all the founders under Sequoia Capital, and they brought in just amazing speakers, right? So I think let's say Michael Phelps, the Olympian swimmer, was there to speak in front of us. They brought in a lot of the unicorn founders. And it was pretty interesting that in their conference, because they got so many unicorn founders, each unicorn founder got 15 minutes to share with me. Right, so it's a pretty interesting where on the stage you will see from Meituan founder to Oyo to Gojek to Tokopedia, and they're all on the stage, right, on the same day, right? And I think it's a pretty interesting bit. So I think that's one. I think if you look at it, 500 durians, 500 startups, Kylie, he's a super connector. He knew all kinds of people anywhere, right? So I think, and he's great at jamming ideas and everything. So I think, interestingly, is that different investors bring different value on board to you, right? So I think a lot of it is that knowing what you're looking for. And because there's no perfect. So let's say, example, there could be people who just want investors' connections, but don't really want to spend a lot of time with investors. But there are maybe some people who want to spend a lot more time with investors. And maybe it also depends what type you want: a big picture visionary, investors that know how to solve your tough time. Maybe the investors that want to be able to help you to give some benchmark or operational metrics or whatnot, right? So I think a lot of those value there. I think in the end is knowing what you're looking for.
Yes, I really could not agree more. I think it comes down to identifying your gaps and your needs, right? Because what you need and what you're missing, I think your investor group can definitely help to fill in. So that's something to really be aware about, right? In terms of the Pine Labs acquisition, so what kind of considerations did you have sort of when you were thinking about them, and why did you end up going through with this acquisition offer?
Yeah, so I think that during 2020, right, last year during COVID, I think our segment got affected quite a lot, right? We serve restaurants, retailers, and a lot of service providers, and a lot of these businesses had to close, right, during restriction based on various countries when COVID spread. Yeah. So our businesses were quite affected. And I think we coincidentally got a chance to connect through with Pine Labs, like Amrish, who newly became Pine Labs CEO, came across us, interestingly, through his wife. And his wife was a big Fave user, so I think from there, came across and connect. And I think we found a lot of understanding, synergy, mutual respect. And I think that's where a lot of that built upon. And I think we went through, jamming through, and see the potential. And I think that's where they think the going through. So I think if you think on it, Pine Labs have built amazing, huge businesses in India, serving merchants over the last many years, right? So I think they have built that. They have came across to Southeast Asia, nearly building up, fast growing. And I think for us, where we building on within Southeast Asia, we have built it through. So I think a lot of it is thinking about how to bring the synergy across these two bits.
Right, right. And I'm definitely looking forward to the progress, and obviously with, the upcoming sort of expansion into the Indian market, definitely looking forward and very excited to see what's to come out of, both Pine Labs and from Fave. So very excited there. Last two questions. What are some unexpected lessons that you have learned from your entrepreneurial journey of Fave that you never saw coming, or that, was a very interesting takeaway for you?
So I think that a lot of times, right, I think as entrepreneurs, when we read the news, we hear, we see it's all the great news, right? This company A raised X dollar, company A succeed in this. So I think from the outside world, you look at, oh, wow, entrepreneurship is glamour. all these people have is super easy. Oh, this unicorn, decacorn, whatever, all those, right? It looks so easy from outside. But I think if you have the chance to speak deep with each entrepreneur, there's just so much tough time, right? That you can't go out there. So let's say example, fundraising. Most of the time when we hear that company A raised 20 million, 50 million, a billion and whatnot, right? A lot of those cases, just before they raise, the company cash balance likelihood is very low. Likelihood the investors, the founders, during the journey to get an investment, likelihood face 5, 10, 20, 50, 100 rejections before you find 1, 2, 3 investors that believe in you and invest big into you. Right, so I think a lot of it, and also of course during due diligence process, during the negotiation process, there's a lot of tough time, right? I think a lot of times it's not a straightforward, oh yeah, high five, we meet, and then say, okay, great, let me put $50 million into the company and let's go and done, right? It's not. There's a lot of details into each of that, and I think really cross-understanding. And I think a lot of it, this is that eventually get tested during the tough time. I think last year, as COVID unfolds, I think that's where a lot of founders, you ask them, then you will know. Which investors really they're sticking and at that point help up the startups? Which investor at that point is trying to capitalize? And which investor is like, hey, where's my money, right? So I think each of that is different, but I think that's one bit. And I think the second is, I think that maybe the other learnings is that I think as a founder, as your company grow, how do we learn, unlearn, and relearn, and basically need to transform ourselves? When we first start the company, what is needed of us is not what the company needed of us when the company is 20 people, 30 people. And again, it's not no longer the same us that is needed when the company is like 200 people, over 2,000 people. And I think as you grow and scale as well, where you, a lot of time you need it to take to the next level, how do you be able to then see at which stage you can bring your existing team to that level? And in which stage you need to basically bring in people from outside and how to make sure that that to blend. Because a lot of time, if you keep purely within the team and the people couldn't scale up, and a lot of time that became a lagging, right? Dragging through. Or if you bring people outside and that person just can't fit into the company, can't fit culture-wise, mindset-wise, style-wise, then it won't work, right? Because the people that may have been through successful big unicorns, when they come to a smaller, earlier stage startup, may not be, it could be quite different because the resources you have is different, the thing mindsets, the thing is different, right? So I think what bring us success to a certain point may not be the things that needed to bring us to the next level.
Okay. Yeah, I really could not agree more. I think that's such an interesting takeaway. For me, I really appreciate that because learning how to learn, unlearn and relearn, right? Because you're right. What works now or what works back then when we had a team of 4 or 5 people might not work when we're trying to scale that to 20 or 30 people, right? And so at different stages of the life cycle of the company, it's very important to keep constantly transforming and evolving our perspectives and ourselves. So that's such a wonderful thought. The last question for today, Chen Chao, is that I want to give you an explanation to the title of the podcast. So with Scalescape, right, scale and scape, right? When we're building a product, we're trying to scale that to as many people as we can. We're trying to find how to kick that product off into, as many people as possible, grow user traction, things like that. But then when we're scaling a product, we need to take into account the landscape, right? So the scape. So things like, product market fit, the geography, the timing, some macro conditions that will help to, some tailwinds that can help to build, the scaling of the product. My last question for you is, what is one tip that you have for founders to scalescape their companies towards success?
Yeah, good, very good question and very good, I think, sharing on how scalescape came about, right? And I think that do the things that can't scale at the start, but once you get it right, then you need to think on how to make it scale, right? So I think like Carousel founder, Siu Rui, I think he's known for like every weekend go to, because Carousel, when they do and sell at all those flea markets and all those things, he's always there, standing there and selling. So I think a lot of that, right? Like for myself, a lot of times I go to restaurants, retail, and just be an anonymous user, go there and just observe how our customer interact, how the cashier, waiter, promoter at the shops tell their customers, right? eventually you need to scale. And I think as you scale also is look at what works. Scale what works, right? Make it super big. Because a lot of times, sometimes we trial many things and whatever work, we don't capitalize on it and scale. So I think it's do that. I think trial different things. What works, build it very big. Whatever doesn't work, tweak. Insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome. And a lot of times it's not just because you have big brands, it works, right? So I'm quite sure that if say you look at it, let's say WhatsApp, do anyone use WhatsApp status? Let's say Facebook. How many of you use go on Facebook stories? Although Facebook is the same company, Instagram people use stories all the time, right? So I think a lot of it is that how do you connect the dot and see it? Think big, start small, fail fast, scale faster.
Oh, I love that. Chinchada, such a great note to end on. Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it and I hope to see you again.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Justin, and all the best in the Skillscape.